History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that really should not go untold. And we've learned they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to ask a few questions and then, of course, invest some time so we can listen patiently as memories from long ago take on new significance in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I promised we'd have an episode focusing on D-Day this week. June 6th marked the 79th anniversary of that longest day and the start of the Allied invasion of Normandy. You can go to hometownheroesradio.com and access quite a few firsthand accounts from those who were directly involved on June 6, 1944, on land, at sea, and in the air. But on this episode, we're going to listen to two of the more famous addresses delivered that day with a little bit of a 2023 twist mixed in. We're also going to hear the story of one of 45 World War II veterans who visited Normandy for the 79th anniversary with our friends from the Best Defense Foundation. If you don't follow the foundation on social media yet, I highly recommend it. You're going to find highlights from their activities in Normandy before, during, and after D-Day's 79th anniversary. And something important happened in Washington, D.C. on the 79th anniversary of D-Day. We're going to talk about that, too. If you were to visit the Dwight Eisenhower Memorial in Washington, you would see a statue depicting Ike talking to paratroopers before they jumped behind enemy lines that day. And the speech he issued to the invasion forces is one that continues to produce goosebumps nearly 8 decades later.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940-41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeats in open battle, man to man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air and their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home fronts have given us an overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war and placed at our disposal great reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
That was General Dwight Eisenhower's message to the troops in Europe on June 6, 1944, while President Franklin D. Roosevelt had a different kind of message to share with the American people back home.
And so, in this poignant hour, I ask you to join with me in prayer. Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor.
That mighty endeavor would help save the world, at a very heavy cost, of course. More about FDR's prayer and how it took center stage in D.C. on the 79th anniversary. But I mentioned that 45 World War II veterans visited Normandy for that anniversary with the Best Defense Foundation, an amazing organization you've heard about before on Hometown Heroes. One of those vets is a World War II nurse we had the privilege of introducing to the Best Defense Foundation team after she shared her story on Hometown Heroes. She celebrated her 102nd birthday in Normandy, but her motivation for serving as an Army nurse came in the wake of a great tragedy in her life. Betty Rosevere's first husband, Billy Lou Huffman, was a pilot who became one of the more than 400,000 Americans to make the ultimate sacrifice in World War II. Betty was the seventh in a family of 10 children that immigrated from her native Alberta, Canada, settling in the southern part of Washington State.
And I went to nurses training in Oregon, Baker, Oregon. And so, I was there several years. That's where I met my first husband. He was in college then, and I was a student nurse. And I met him at a dance.
Well, I want to hear about that. When you're the seventh of 10 children, that has to be an entertaining existence.
Yes.
I imagine that means all the kids have to do something to contribute to the family, to the farm, to the household. What do you remember about that childhood in the 1920s? What were some of the things that you had to do?
I churned the butter every Saturday. It was a big wooden thing that you put the, my mother put all the milk in it, and or probably she saved the some of the heavy milk for it. And then I was the only one had the patience to sit there and pump it up and down. But actually, we didn't have many tasks on the farm, really. My dad worked in town. My mother was very efficient. But everything was pretty well organized, mm-hmm. So we didn't have to do too much. But we rode the bus to school because we lived out of the city town about 8 miles. But we had a wonderful life on the farm. We used to go walk around, take people up. We had a lot of relatives that came to visit from Nebraska and different places, and we would take them up in the hills. And we had a little stream that ran through the farm, and we used to go down and take something out of the garden. My dad had a nice, great, big vegetable garden, and we could stick carrots or something in the water and wash them off and eat them.
So how'd you get along with those 9 siblings?
Well, actually, we really did pretty well. But I had, most of mine were sisters, so my brothers were all older. So that was like a big separation. But my sisters were pals. Like we used to go for walks together and do things together, you know. And they were really good at. We never got many presents for Christmas, except underwear and stockings. Then when I was about 13, my dad wheeled out of the bedroom a girl's bicycle.
Ooh.
So my younger sister, or some of my sisters and I, were always out on the bicycle, going up and down this gravel road, pumping away.
Taking turns.
Yeah, taking turns, yeah.
I have 2 teenage daughters, and they love each other. But if it's up to whose turn is it, sometimes there's a disagreement about whose turn it is. So when you have 7 girls taking turns on one bicycle...
No, they didn't. My older ones didn't bother. It was the younger ones.
So it was only 3 or 4 girls taking turns on one bicycle?
Yeah.
Yet you all lived to tell the story. And I imagine life was different for a young girl then than it is in 2021.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, in some ways it wasn't. You know, we used to do each other's hair and things like that. But I never had long hair because my mother was great at cutting hair. If you have all those girls, you don't have long hair.
She had to manage it, huh?
Yeah, right.
I have to ask, because the people that lived through this time, everyone experienced it differently, and some have vivid memories, some don't. But those depression years, did you see that weigh on your parents? Did you see your family dealing with that economic hardship in a way that helped you get through it?
I don't think as we did as much as other people. Somehow or other, my mother and father were very good at taking care of things. My mother would even save money. We always felt fairly good about how things were at that time. When we talk about it, when I talk about it with my sisters, I only have one left now. But we always talked about the good things, you know, that happened, that were really good. We were really lucky that we didn't have all of the problems that other people had. Mm-hmm. People who didn't have the land. My dad had 45 acres, so that meant you had all firewood you needed, you know, things like that.
And I bring up the difference between young ladies now and then, because today, if you're a girl going to school, there's nothing that's off the table, right? There's any kind of job, any kind of career that is an option for you. When you were a young lady, that wasn't necessarily the case. Did you have an idea growing up of, here's something that I am going to be able to do with my life, that I want to do with my life?
No, I think it was harder then. you know, to get some kind of job. I was lucky. One of my sisters lived in Eastern Oregon, and she wanted me to come and visit her. So I went there, and she said to me, "Why don't you go to the hospital here? They're taking in student nurses." Mm-hmm. And so in 2 weeks, I was a student nurse after I finished high school. So somehow or other, I don't know. I think I had it easier than some people did. But I had a lot of friends that had a hard time, and families that one of my best friends, her father died and her mother had the two children. Her brother stayed with cousins because they had no place to live. And then she became a student nurse like I did. We were in high school together, you know, so we thought we were lucky because a lot of people weren't able to do that. I don't know. It turned out really well for me because I liked it.
Well, but you would deal with some hardships as well that we're going to hear about. What was it about nursing that was a draw for you? What appealed to you about that career?
Well, I always liked doing things for people. I take care of Vic, you know.
Yeah.
And I took care of my husband when he was at a bad heart, was ill for few years. And I always kind of liked doing that, so it was easy for me.
So this is all before World War II still, at least before America's in the war.
Right.
So you go to nursing school there in Baker City, you said, Eastern Oregon.
Right.
Become a nurse. When did you meet Billy?
Well, he was in college at the State College. His father lived on a farm. His mother died when he was born, and he had a very, very nice stepmother, and he was the only child, though, which was a terrible tragedy for him, for his father. I went to a dance with some of the nurses would go to this place where they used to have bands that came and played in a hall someplace.
Sure.
We went off there, and I met him there.
And was this before Pearl Harbor still?
Yes. Oh, yes. He was still in college then. About the last year as a student nurse, I went to take my boards in Oregon, and I worked at a children's hospital when they had a polio pandemic. It was really bad. Then he went to Texas for training to be a pilot. So then he called me up. I'd known him then probably off and on about 2 years because he went back to school, and then I was still in Baker, Oregon, and I finished there. Then I was in Portland when he called me and asked me if I would marry him, and I said yes.
So he proposed over the phone?
Yes, yeah. Uh-huh. Well, we kind of knew that anyhow by that time, yeah. But he was kind of shy, and so was I. Maybe it was easier for him on the phone, you know?
Maybe.
And people were different in those days, you know. He came to Portland, and we got married in Portland, Oregon. And then we were together off and on for a while. And then he moved to a field in Walla Walla, Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were together there for a while, for about a few weeks. And then eventually he went to South Dakota, Rapid City, I think it's called. And I went there, flew there to see him, and then he went to England. So that was the last time I saw him.
You met him. He's a college student. He becomes a pilot. You guys are married. But then America's at war.
Yes.
And he's being sent overseas.
Yes. Well, one thing about him was that his mother died when he was born, maybe 2 weeks after he was born. And she called him Billy Lou. And when, after the war, you know, after all this happened, I got in touch with the 452nd group. First thing they asked me was he from the South?
Because of Billy Lou?
He didn't look like a Billy Lou. So they said, well, then he named his airplane Mavourin, and that's a song that I used to sing to him. He loved that song. I don't know. It's not really anything special, but it's what the nuns used to sing together. So they taught it to me because I kind of liked it. It's Come Back to Erin, Mavourin, Mavourin. I can't sing anymore. Come back, Aroon, for the land of your birth. And so he loved that song. That's the first thing. Those two things they asked me. Was he from the South? And why did he name his ship Mavourin?
And that's why.
Yeah. My daughter then, by that time, I didn't talk to him about him for years. And my daughter said to me, could we find out some more about him? And so I said, okay. So she's the one who went on the computer and found all kinds of stuff. And then they sent me every month
the Bomb Group newsletter?
Yeah, they had a group, you know, that they got together. And they wanted me to come, but I don't remember, someplace else. And I was always busy. I lived in a lot of different countries, as you can see by all the things.
Yeah.
Yeah. The sad thing, I think the hardest part for me was his father. First he lost his wife, and then Billy was only about 22 or 3 or something like that. And then he loses his only son.
Yeah.
And he didn't last very long after that. He died. What we talk about, a broken heart, he had that, you know. And it was really terrible. Yeah. It was terrible for me, but I think his father was the one I sympathized with the most. It was just as if he took his whole life away.
And I know, even though it's been this long, this is something that can still trigger a lot of powerful emotions, and I want to be sensitive to that.
Yeah.
But what can you tell me about Billy? What kind of guy was he? What was it that made you love him the way you did?
Well, he was just very kind and sort of shy. He loved taking pictures, took so many pictures of me. He was very good at doing a lot of things. He loved being with people. He was always happy, but he wasn't very talkative. When we used to go out for dinner with somebody when we were in Walla Walla, we just had a room in a house, so we always went out with several people from his group. And we always had such a good time. He was just a really nice, quiet, sweet person. Yeah. I'm lucky, you know, that my second husband was like that, too.
So you met some of his crew before they shipped out?
Yes, I did, but I don't remember. I remember one because there's a guy who comes on TV, looks just like him, with the same last name, Mattingly. And I keep wondering, I wonder if he is a relative of Howard Mattingly. He was a navigator on another plane, and they were good friends. So we got together, and he was married, too. And he had a really nice young wife, and we always had such good times together. This was in Walla Walla, Washington. His plane disappeared. I heard later on, I read some things about different planes that they had found. They found some of the people on his plane. It was down in someplace in Europe in the water, and they never found him. But I used to write to his wife. She remarried like I did. She had 4 children. I had 3, and we used to go back and forth about it.
Yeah,
it was a bad time. We had wonderful times together, though. It wasn't too upsetting until until he left, and then I knew then. When I went to South Dakota, I knew that was the last time I would see him. I only saw him for the weekend, and then he was gone again.
Are you suggesting that you had a premonition or an inkling that something would happen to him?
No, I didn't. I wrote to him every single day. I wrote to him, and he wrote to me as much as he could. No, I never. He was always so self-assured, you know. He was a good pilot. He was very friendly, but it was probably too good at what he did. He was in the front of the Big Week. Do you remember?
Leading the formation?
Yeah. Did you ever read anything about Big Week, the 2 weeks when they were, that was February 20th and on, the 2 weeks then, when they put up all those planes?
Yeah.
Now he was one of the leading planes. It was just too hard to believe that it was all so quickly, you know. We were married on the day before my birthday, June 3rd, and I think he was gone the next year. It wasn't very long. We were together in Walla Walla. It all went so fast. Sometimes I forget the dates because it seemed like we were just constantly moving or doing something.
It's time for our first break, but we'll hear more of Betty's story when we come back. Follow the Best Defense Foundation on Facebook or Instagram to see some of the places Betty has visited in Normandy over the past week. And before we're done, we're going to hear from Franklin Delano Roosevelt's great-grandson, who had a very special privilege on D-Day's 79th anniversary. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.